Vanti, and I'm here with my friend
Zion.
Z, what are you saying? Every creative project needs the right space.
It does. We're building Winnipeg's creative hub for recording, photography, videography, and content creation.
We also rent spaces out for podcasts, events, and all our studio sessions come with a pro engineer included. The first 30 minutes of every recording session is free. If you're coming for graduation pictures, wear your bet. Not to mention, we have a 30% discount off every service we offer. To get started,
email us at mile12productions@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at mile12productions. Check our previous works, book a studio session, explore our artist lunch packages, or connect with all our creative communities.
I think we've said enough. How about we leave the rest to them?
How about they come see for themselves?
All right.
Come on.
Since first introducing the world to the sound of Kiwa's golden era, Buena Vista Social Club has become one of the most celebrated musical legacies in history, a living tradition that continues to bring generations of musicians together from Havana to sold-out stages around the world. Now carried forward by Buena Vista Orchestra, the music returns with a powerhouse lineup led by violinist Rolando Morejon Reyes and a stellar band of world-class players connected to the Buena Vista Social Club, Celia Cruz, the Afro-Cuban All-Stars, and more, keeping the classic sound alive and in motion. Don't miss Buena Vista Orchestra at the historic Burton Cummings Theater Sunday, October 25th. Great tickets are on sale now, starting at $39.50 plus fees, available through Ticketmaster.ca. Don't miss Buena Vista Orchestra live at the Burton Cummings Theater, October 25th, proudly supported by UMFM 101.5.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is John Seymour, publisher, author, storyteller, and illustrator based in Ontario, Canada. John founded Tumor Press Publishing Company, Canadian independent children's book publisher focused on creating high-quality, nature-themed children's picture books that connect young readers with the natural world. Tumor Press publishes stories that entertain, educate, and inspire children. Titles in their catalog explore such topics as sloth ecosystems, marine environments, fireflies, the moon, and more. Their books often include educational activities such as seek and find activities, glossaries, and discussion questions. A portion of the proceeds from every Tumor Press book sale goes towards organizations that support the natural environment, children's literacy programs, and local children's hospitals. Environmental responsibility is a core part of their mission, and Tumor Press has partnered with One Tree Planted, contributing to planting over 1,700 trees as of 2026 as part of the organization's ongoing reforestation efforts. Tumor Press offers a number of programs and resources for communities and schools, such as author mentorships, author illustrator visits, lesson plans, and activities to accompany publications in their topics. They also sponsor the hit KidLit podcast called You May Contribute a Verse, which covers topics related to children's literature, the creative journey of publishing, and the KidLit community. Tumor Press accepts manuscript submissions from local and global authors and illustrators within windowed periods and have published numerous fantastic titles with more to come. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much, and wow, what an intro. That was amazing.
You wear a number of hats as a publisher, author, storyteller, and illustrator. Can you share some of your early memories of your talent and passion for storytelling, art, and business?
Oh, yeah. So they all start on different periods of my life. The business was always something I had been interested in as a budding adult. I was always interested in business, and I had tried different business opportunities. Nothing really panned out. Actually, that story is how we came up with the name Tealmore. I had a number of businesses. I think one was a sports clothing company that didn't pan out very well. And then I tried getting into some car online forums and then into like solar energy. And it's just all over. I was just so interested in the idea of business. And so a lot of them had the name Teal in them. And I was like, okay, well, Warren Buffett did that thing where he kept his company name across his company. So I was like, oh, I'll just do that. And then so since my last name is Seymour, I was like, oh, Teal Moore. So that's a fun fact. But the business part has been always something I've been interested in. I have always loved kids' books, obviously more when I was a kid. And I have very fond memories of certain books when I was a kid. But obviously with most people, this fire is reignited when you have your own kids because you're forced to read them again. And it's just like, ah, these are great. I miss this. And then that transitions into, hey, maybe I can write these. And then that's usually the origin story for most authors. So tried that, tried my hand at it. It went okay. My first book that I published was with a hybrid publisher. So it was one of those publishers where I had to pay them to publish. The experience wasn't great, but that experience led me to come up with this conclusion. Oh, well, if this experience was so terrible and I paid money and they can do that, then what happens if I just go on my own and actually just try self-publishing? So it started with the self-publishing journey, and then going back to how there were some books in my youth that really inspired me. Shel Silverstein, I'm such a big fan of his work, and that came out in some of my first attempts at self-publishing books. And I self-published maybe 3 or 4 books. And then I started seeing that sales were coming from all over the globe, a couple of sales in Australia. I was like, what? I'm not really doing much here. Imagine if I actually tried to aim for this. And then so did my research, connected all of those things together, you know, business and what I learned with publishing and writing and illustrating. I was like, oh, okay. If the planets were to align, this sort of feels like what I need to do. So Kilmore Press was born.
What was your first book and what inspired you to write it?
So the first book, and that was under a pen name. So that one was called Crocodile Birds. And it was a rhyming book, as most first-time authors do. They write a rhyming book for the first time because it's like, oh, rhyming's fun. Rhyming's easy to be young and naive. Rhyming is so hard. But it was fun. It was just like, you know what? I want to write something silly and something that I know my kids will enjoy based on what they find funny and all that. So I wrote it for them, as most people do, again. I had it self-published. I paid my money, which was a mistake, but it wasn't, because it was a great learning experience. I just counted it as an unplanned semester at college or university. It was just sort of like a tuition fee, if you will. There wasn't a lot that I learned. And so I made that book. It's okay. I mean, now I know, looking back at it, it's like, yeah, I probably could use some work, but, you know, it's fine. And then my first self-published book, which was, if you see it, is very heavy on the Shel Silverstein side. It's black and white ink. I used my fountain pen, like a dip pen, and I did all my art on paper. And I love that book. Bookstores don't like it, but I love that book. And that's okay.
And the kids must love it.
So the kids that read it like it, and I think I've had feedback that they love it a lot. There is this thing that happens, which is really interesting, in that because it's a black and white book and it's just like outline, stencil, some shading, very simple graphics. I didn't want it to be too stimulating, also because my son was autistic and I just wanted to be like, okay, low stim, you know, easy words, a lot of silly things, onomatopoeia, a lot of sound words. But the kids who pick it up in my local area and around, I always hear that they start coloring it. I was like, oh, that's really cool. I can't advocate for kids to color these books because that's a slippery slope. But I mean, I don't mind. I think it's pretty cool.
So have you had any fine arts training, anything like that?
No, not at all. So what's interesting is I've always been a creative person and I almost thrive on creating things, any kind of medium, whether it's paint, drawing, trying to sculpt with wood, anything. I like the art of art, like the art of creating, and I've always been into that. So the illustration side was a bit more natural to me, although I need far more practice than I had realized. So like anything, it's just muscle memory. It's getting the reps in. So I will practice that at some point. The writing took a long time for me to develop. And I had started a critique group. I had gone to some writing classes and courses, nothing formal with post-secondary education or anything like that, but different academies, if you will. And that helped fine-tune a lot of my writing. And then in learning how to write and understanding what the feedback was, I picked up on, this is what's expected from children's books. Here's the techniques and different outcomes that I could use for a story. And one of the things that I really, I guess you could say I took pride on, is I had hired an editor in BC. And she was fantastic. She was just absolutely lovely to work with. And she was very honed in on how to, you know, correct my grammar, my sentence structure and everything. And she was saying things that I was like, wow, that's way above my level. But I would send her my stories and I would pay for it. And then I would check to see how she's correcting it and then save those corrections and use that going forward. So I'd always take stock of her corrections, almost like my own little dictionary of my editor. And that's what I used to work on my stories going forward. And then as I learned to publish, I still work with a lot of different people, different editors, because while I can write books and I can identify what works in a book and what works in a story and what makes a story really intriguing and engaging with kids, it still needs a lot of expertise. So I wouldn't, while I'll do a first pass to check basic grammar, sentence structure, developmentalist, stuff like that, I always send it out to a proper editor to make sure that they put their professional eyes on it and make sure it gets to where it needs to be.
In having done the writing yourself and the illustrations, how does that influence the artists and authors that you will publish for Two More Press?
I think it opens up a few pathways. One, it's a huge sense of appreciation for the time and effort that different artists put into their craft. It's, I guess, like I said, I've been doing different kinds of art and a lot of drawing for a large period of my life. And these artists that I work with are just so beyond what I could comprehend. And it's just like, I know how many years I've worked on drawing and art, but very casually. And they're just leagues ahead of me. And it's so impressive and it's so awe-inspiring. And it's the same with writing. A lot of writers that I've worked with or that have engaged with me, they're so talented. Most are. A lot of them are maybe in their first iterations of starting their career in writing. And I can tell that. And that's the second path, is I can see where people are in their trajectory based on what they provide me. So with writing, there was a rhyming story. I can tell when the meter seems a little off, or with illustrations, I can see if there's a lack of perspective. It feels maybe a bit flat, then I can just gauge where they are in their career path. So it has allowed me to have different viewpoints on the people I work with, and mostly their craft and how that might work or translate into a project.
Who might be a few of your authors and illustrators, and perhaps give us a few examples of their book titles and a little of what you find most exciting about their stories?
Well, we have two books from Alicia Gabriel. She's in the United States. Absolutely wonderful person. We have our first nonfiction book, which is called Fungi Are. So it's about mushrooms. So Fungi Are More Than Mushrooms. And it was paired with an illustrator who we've also partnered with, so Vivian Sarkany, and I hope I'm saying that right, but we worked on that project together, and it was so lovely. We purposely went for very earthy tones. It's a very earth-based concept, and it's just very brown and kind of dialed in, and it was so great. And I remember Kirkus ripped us a new one. They're like, oh, the illustrations are drab. I was like, wow, thanks, Kirk. It's like, I don't care because I like it and we like it, all of us on the project, and we have great feedback. And so we have our second one with the same author illustrator. And this one's called Tricksters, Takers, and Team Players. And it's more about how different species of animals can coexist and have relationships and even partnerships, so symbiotic relationships in their habitat and how they go about coexisting. So it's really, really cool. We have, I'd say, I have two other illustrators that have done several projects for Two More Press. One is Maya Tran, and she's absolutely lovely to work with. Everyone I've worked with has been so awesome. So Maya Tran has done a couple of books for us, and Gabby Morez, which I know you know, she's been so wonderful to work with, and she's done a few projects. And so she's wrapping up our first graphic novel. So that'll be exciting. So that'll be Dudes of Disposal. Further announcements coming.
You've done a number of entertaining storytelling videos online at the Hook Book Barrel for children to listen to and discover the magic of storytelling in action, told with great enthusiasm and taking opportunities for fun teaching moments on topics children may be curious about. Can you tell us more about these and give us an example?
That's really interesting. I have been trying to keep those separated, and I didn't think there was a direct link between those. You've done a really great job doing research, because I don't think I've mentioned that show on anything Two More Press yet, or maybe I might have alluded to it once. And on the show, I've never talked about the press. I was just like, maybe they'll just be their own entities and see how that happens. So the Hook Book Barrel is winding down a little bit because I have to prioritize my resources as a single dad, full-time job, full-time publishing, plus show, plus, you know, everything else. So just trying to put my ducks in a row. I was on a schedule of creating an episode every week, and I did that for several months. And that was just way too intensive. Plus, I had paid an editor, which was all out of pocket. And I was like, I don't think I can afford this anymore. So I'm trying to do it once a month. And so the Hookbook Barrel was my attempt at sort of reviving the Reading Rainbow theme and trend. And I had started this before Reading Rainbow actually got revived. I was like, oh, man, like, I should have started early, but that's okay. And so I just did what I thought, A, that my kids would enjoy, and then B, I use it as an opportunity to learn more about YouTube, which is another medium I wasn't familiar with. So it's long form content. So that was a really great immersion into that. And then it was in a not an unplanned way, it was getting more experience from the reading end. So obviously I read books, I wrote books, I published books, and finding out other aspects of the industry that I could get more experience in. So through reading other people's books aloud to a public audience, I started realizing different things about what I liked and what I didn't like about books. And so it just adds another piece to the puzzle for publishing at the very least. So it was very, very interesting learning experience. From the show itself, it was always aimed at trying to be educational and silly and introduce books. And the vibe, or I guess the idea that was stuck in my head, is as a millennial, I wanted to revive all these different pieces of 90s TV shows that I remember watching when I was younger. So maybe some Bill Nye stuff. So I always try to include some sort of learning, silly, maybe science or nature-based stuff. And then Reading Rainbow for the actual reading and getting kids maybe excited about reading. And then there's the Blues Clues piece with interacting with the viewer, asking a question, and then maybe a bit more, I guess you can call it contemporary, but nowadays TV. So while I'm not a big fan of Blippi, the point here is that Blippi is adored by kids for some reason. And Blippi is a TV show where it's just this guy, Blippi, is just really silly and over the top. I think that's just it, like over the top silly. And I remember watching it when my son was watching it. I think we were just putting TV on just to cook dinner or something. And I was just like, what is he watching? It's so silly and weird. And it's just like, I don't like it, but he was enthralled. And then my kids, like when my daughters came around, they saw it and they were both immersed into the show. And I'm trying to take a step back and think, okay, so what is it that's calling them to this? And my best guess is that that actor or that show was able to act or portray themselves as in a kid-friendly way, as close to as possible, so that kids felt like it was on their level. It was like an adult coming down to a kid's level, but more genuinely. Like, it's so silly to see. It was almost, I don't know what the word is, but it was very strange to see an adult act like that level of a child. But the kids loved it because maybe they were like, oh, he's playing like I would. Here's some balls and toys and stuff like that. So I took that as a mental note. I understood that kids really enjoy it, or they feel engaged, or maybe they feel seen when an adult comes down to their level instead of an adult being an adult talking to a child, not talking down, but taking just that position between an adult and a child. But if the child sees the adult as a child, then it's maybe more engaging, or maybe they enjoy it, or maybe they'll be able to learn. Or if that adult is reading books, maybe the kids, I don't know. So there was a whole bunch of things that went into it, as I digress. So that is my kids' show.
Can you tell us a little about your upcoming mentorship program for emerging authors?
That's also super interesting too, because I had mentioned it, I think, once on a social media post. And now I'm hearing about it. Someone else reached out to me to do a blog entry about this mentorship. I was just like, hey, I have an idea. Let me know what you think. I don't know if I'll do it, but people really picked up on it. I was like, okay, this is something I have to do. Yeah. So while it's not finished, the initial idea is to work with new or emerging authors and to get them up to a place where we can work on their story development, their craft, maybe work through some of their submission techniques and how they're going to approach editors, agents, publishers. Not sure yet, but I think that's where I'm taking this is I could work with authors of all calibers, but I think the more seasoned writers and authors will take less away because they're so experienced than a brand new author would. So, and I guess that's just more of an empathetic approach to it because I remember being a first-time author and I remember how discouraging it was to send out my story into the abyss and just hope. And it was actually that whole concept of hope which made me frustrated enough to push towards self-publishing. I don't like hope because hope, I can't strategize and work around hope. I want to do something. I want to do something about it. So I was like, I'm just going to publish my books. And if someone likes my other stuff in the meantime, great. But I need to keep moving. So that's why I did that.
What are some of the challenges of getting work published? And how would you advise aspiring authors and illustrators to approach publishers or you?
The challenges of publishing, I think in the world of publishing as a whole, which is mostly dominated by big five, big six, however you see that, indie publishers, especially new startups or emerging startups or some that are fairly established, it feels like the industry is not made for indie publishers to exist. Maybe that's a bit contrarian, but it's been so difficult to find a way to make this business work. Even from the business side, it's super challenging. Logistics is also very challenging. And it feels like the major companies that have the monopoly around everything, they built this industry to serve them. Everyone else is left picking up the pieces to try and squeeze their way in somehow. And that's how I've come to experience it. And I work with a lot of different indie publishers. I have my own indie publisher group that we meet once a month and we talk through different challenges and try to support each other. And everyone is going through an incredibly hard time because the idea of starting a publishing press is so great and magical. And it's just like, oh yeah, we get to bring these books into existence. But the information you need to make those decisions to say whether this is a good idea or not is really hard to obtain until you're in the thick of it. And that's been the common trend for everyone. With that said, the common challenges are one, trying to find a place for yourself in the industry that's not meant for you. There's a lot of helpful resources. There's a lot of organizations that do try to help small presses. And we've had a lot of success in trying to always get to the next step. So it's great that you want to be a publisher, but the biggest step is distribution. You can't get distribution without a few titles and some sales. So it's a waterfall approach. You can't get this if you don't have that. And then to have a sales team, which is very important. You can't have a sales team unless you have distribution. You can't have distribution unless you have titles and sales. And then it just goes on and on. And then if we wanted to, we're still trying to push for more international distribution, but we can't have international distribution until our sales are plus 200,000 a year, something like that. So we're still relatively new. We've only been operating for a couple of years. So still have a little ways to go. But it's this giant waterfall approach, which has also become a big barrier. So other than that, economic factors are huge. So tariffs, absolutely brutal. A lot of our authors, because we started our submissions opened up internationally, we didn't cater to just Canadian artists. We had a lot of US-based authors and illustrators. And the thing with that is they want to sell to their local area. They want to sell in different areas. And there is a barrier because we're Canada, they're US, no problem. Tariffs just destroyed that. Like almost all of our US sales are at that time when it was fresh, it was non-existent. Then Canada Post went on strike and then we had to can sales on our website because the shipping cost was $25, which is more than a book per book. But we can't do that. We can't ask someone to pay $50 for a book when they can get it in their local area or if you must on Amazon. So I think those are really, really big challenges. I mean, they still continue to be challenging, but I think there was a point where you have to understand as a business owner, the challenges never go away. It's just, they take different forms and shapes. And that's the whole point of being a business owner is to solve problems in different ways, shape or forms. And if you can be creative about it, then you'll probably do okay.
Environmental responsibility is a core part of your mission, and Two More Press has partnered with One Tree Planted, contributing to planting over 1,700 trees as of 2026. Would you like to share a little more about this organization you support and a few of the other programs you're involved with?
Yes, and this is a really fun topic because this became our identity. It wasn't the identity on the outset. One of the hardest things about starting a brand in the business is, what is the identity of Two More Press? And so we tried different things. And then I was always trying to think, okay, we can make books, but how do we make a book more than a book? How do we make people feel proud about this book? What does that mean? And I was trying to think of different ways. It would be really cool if it made an impact in the world. That would be super neat if we can figure out a way to make that happen. So our first few books, we worked with different organizations. So a lot of them go to the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario. I think three of our books, we donate a small portion of the profits to different organizations such as CHEO. And then we donate a portion of the profits to both One Tree Planted and Tree Canada. And as we continued with whether or not it was a good idea to donate our profits as a struggling press, that's a totally different topic. But as we continued doing that, is, wait a minute, we can try to work through this and see if we can plant a tree with our books that we sell. And then we tried to do the calculations and figure out what was the loss if we do it this way. And because at the end of the day, we still have to make money somehow. We are a for-profit business. So what we ended up doing is most of our books, I'd say pre-2026, I think all of them pre-2026, they contribute proceeds to One Tree Planted, Tree Canada, and a charity usually of the author's choice. And we stopped the author's choice charity because, one, some of the charities were hard to get a hold of and it was hard to do all these different logistics. And then we also realized that if we put our eggs more in one basket, we might be able to make a bigger impact towards reforestation. And that felt like the right move based on how we were positioning ourselves. And then that turned into, now these books, which consume trees in a way, or use trees to create a book, now we can give back and almost take a regenerative approach to this. So we focus more on the tree planting. And with every hardcover book sold, we donate enough money to plant a single tree for every hardcover book sold. So our goal this year is to try and double it. We're going to try to double 1,700 and see how that goes. Again, it's very aggressive, and we've made some aggressive plays in the past that haven't panned out. But you know what? I don't like half measures. I don't like, let's do this lightly. I just go big or go home.
You're getting your submissions ready for 2027. Can you tell us a little bit how this works and what the procedure and requirements are for your author illustrators?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a little bit different for authors and illustrators. We do have illustrators submit their portfolio to us, and we keep those and we have them as reference if we find a suitable project. Sometimes we look for different illustrators that have maybe a style or skill set that we have more in mind in the back of our head when we think about what this project could look like. So we do focus more on author submissions. And so how we did it before is we had I think it was just a Google form, and we had the author fill it out and provide all the details, the synopsis, the pitch, the target reading age, about the story, about them, and then the story itself. I think it'll be very similar, but there's a couple of tweaks that we're going to change, and I guess you're the first to know about it because we haven't announced this yet. So hot off the press. Is that a pun? That feels like a really good pun. Hot off the press. Okay. I'm going to use that on social media. Actually, that's great. So something that we've advocated for recently, and it was actually one of our more engaging social media posts, is that when authors submit to editors and agents and publishers, there's no formal agreement that the work they're submitting is not going to be used for AI. And that was never an issue in the past because AI has come up so quickly. And when I hear that major publishers are developing in-house generative AI models, my mind goes to a couple of places. One, they're likely going to use children's books to start because it feels like to them it's low hanging fruit. It's like only 500 words or less or something like that. And then I was like, okay, if that's true, I don't know, it's speculation, but if that's true, then where are they getting their data? Because if you're training it in-house, you need a ton of data, an immense amount of data. My role for my work is I work with data scientists to develop different algorithms for pediatric healthcare. So I am in the mix with AI and different model development and stuff like that. I get it. And so I was thinking like, well, where do they get their data? They can't use actual published work because people will be raising pitchforks immediately and they won't want that. And then I was like, oh, but if they get like 100,000 submissions every year for the past how many decades, they probably have all the data they need to train their models. Again, speculation, I don't know. But that led me to think that it's true. There's nothing in place to protect authors from having their submitted work used for AI development or generative model development. So all that to say, one of the requirements we're going to be pushing is that they include a blurb saying that we are not allowed to use this for AI development, blah, 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 blah. And that's to hopefully get authors used to including that. We don't need it. We're going to try to update our terms of use to make sure that that's very clear with the submission, or we'll have our own submission policy. But for any other publisher that may not have that or is thinking like, oh, yeah, this is free data, you know, we can do whatever we want with this, I'm hoping that maybe this helps. So that's the first update, is that they have to include an AI disclaimer. And then the second part, which I think is just me being silly, is I'm tempted to make everyone who wants to submit, they have to take a picture of them picking up a piece of garbage outside. And I like doing things that no one else has done. And this is one of those things. And if you want to submit to us, then you got to do a little extra work to help the community, and then we'll be okay. Because that's what our identity is. It's helping the natural world around us. So hopefully it'll get people more involved. So don't know if that's going to mean we have zero submissions if we ask for that, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your captivating story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much, Susan.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
Come on, come on! What are you waiting for?
Daddy needs his medicine. I'm sick, baby. I'm sick. Come on, baby. Daddy needs his feel-good juice. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the stuff. That's what Daddy needs. Yeah, yeah, yeah. See, what it is we're all community. And when you're a community and when love enters into it,
just give me Indie Rock!
UMFM 101.5, broadcasting 1,200 watts from the University of Manitoba, giving Winnipeg and the surrounding community the good stuff since 1998.
Hey there, the Sandwich King of South St. Vitale is taking the summer off. Until he returns, here's a classic episode of Dagwood Radio to cure what ails you.